Everyone's attention, please. We are going to get started in just a few minutes. Quick reminder, please turn off your cell phones if you haven't already. And a couple events tomorrow and Friday. Tomorrow, Mark Brody, founder and president of Panda Mountain, is going to talk about resettlement of indigenous villagers' challenges for panda bear conservation. Why not? And on Friday, similar topic, Larry Lipscher, an American accountant, is going to talk about the long arm of the IRS, which is very long. If you're not American, say your graces. You might have seen that the flyers actually list this event as on Thursday, April 9th, just so there's no confusion, that's Friday, April 9th. Today's guest is no stranger to us. Ambassador John Bolton spoke here just last year, and we're very, very glad to have him back. He's packed the house again. He now hangs his hat at the American Enterprise Institute, where he's a senior fellow, and a lot of the writing that you'll see, especially in the Wall Street Journal, not enough in the Financial Times, unfortunately, will reference his AEI designation. He is also a lawyer, a litigator by experience, and is still very active in that. He describes himself as, quote, a political person in exile. He's obviously hopeful that the exile will last only another 2.5 years, not 6.5. Most of you will remember Ambassador Bolton from his days as permanent representative to the United Nations for the U.S. from August 2005 till the end of 2006. You may have forgotten that before that he was Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security in the Bush administration, and suffice it to say he took a different approach to arms control than the Obama administration is doing. Ambassador Bolton, welcome back to Hong Kong, and thanks for coming to the FCC.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank all of you for attending today. I thought what I would do would be to give a report card of the first 14 months of the Obama administration, and then given the nature of this audience in particular, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about that subject or anything else that might be on your mind. So I will try and not ramble on too long here, so we can have plenty of time for questions if that suits you. I think that Barack Obama is a very different kind of president, and I think he is a substantial deviation from the line of American presidents, at least since Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, particularly on national security, although on domestic policy as well, I have called him the first post-American president. And I want to be clear, I mean by that not un-American, not anti-American, but post-American. In the same way you find people from the Netherlands or Germany saying, well, I'm not German, I'm a European. I'm sort of post-nationalist in the European context. Barack Obama takes it the next step. He is post-American, a citizen of the world. And I think that reflects itself in a variety of his policies, but also is an important descriptor of what he sees his role as president and what he sees as the role for the United States in the world. And this really stems from the proposition that, unlike all other American presidents, he does not believe in what we call American exceptionalism, which is the idea that America is a different kind of country than all the other countries in the world. Now, I know this is a controversial subject, especially in a room with only scattered American citizens around. So let me just say that the concept of American exceptionalism was not created by Americans, it was created by Europeans. The first being Governor Bradford of the Plymouth Colony, who, even though he was in Plymouth, was a Brit at the time, who said, quoting scripture, that that this new settlement of the Puritans in America would make them like a city on the hill, meaning Jerusalem, often referred to in subsequent conversations as America's the new Jerusalem. And you'll recall Ronald Reagan's editing of that phrase where he talked about America being a shining city on a hill, not letting the scriptures go to waste, but improving on them. The first commentator actually to use the word exceptional was, surprisingly, the Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville, who in Democracy in America said the condition of the Americans is truly exceptional and may not ever be duplicated by another democratic country. I don't think Obama believes that, basically. Now, on his first trip to Europe, he was asked by a correspondent, I think from the Financial Times, no less, if he believed in American exceptionalism. And so, being an astute enough politician to be elected president, he said the following: yes, I believe in American exceptionalism. So that's the first third of the sentence that he answered with. He then went on to say, just as I believe the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism. Now, there are 192 countries in the United Nations. He had 189 to go, and he could have said, just as the Ecuadorians believe in Ecuadorian exceptionalism, just as the Burkina Fasians believe in Burkina Fasian exceptionalism, and just as the Papua New Guineans believe in Papua New Guinean exceptionalism. Obviously, if everybody's exceptional, nobody is. And that's really, I think, what it comes down to for Obama. He was described by one of the European students who listened to one of his speeches in Europe, ecstatically, again quoted, I think, in the Financial Times, this student saying, he sounds just like a European. And indeed he does, which is one reason his opinion ratings are so high in Europe, especially compared to what they are in the United States these days. But his view of America's role in the world stems also from, I think, his basic lack of interest in foreign policy. Again, unlike American presidents since Franklin Roosevelt, he is not fundamentally motivated when he gets up in the morning by concerns about international affairs or American security. He's motivated by his desire to restructure the American healthcare system, restructure the American financial system, restructure the American energy system. Well, you get the point. That's what he wants to do, number one. Number two, he doesn't believe that the rest of the world is terribly threatening or challenging to American interests or those of its friends and allies. He said, for example, during the campaign, that Iran is just a tiny country. And really not a threat of the kind that the Soviet Union posed during the Cold War. Now, that's certainly true in the sense that Iran, even today, doesn't have a nuclear arsenal the size of the Soviet Union's, but it's of small solace when a tiny country, take North Korea, drops a tiny nuclear weapon on, Seattle. It's not much solace to the people who are incinerated that they were obliterated by a tiny country. And in fact, other tiny countries that happen to be American allies don't take much satisfaction in the proposition that they can be destroyed by a tiny threat like Iran. So this these two factors, the idea that the world is not that threatening and he's not that much interested in what goes on outside the United States anyway, combined with a lack of strong belief in American exceptionalism, in olden days would have signaled a return to American isolationism. But that's not where Obama comes out. He instead takes refuge in multilateralism, and in the idea that the United States is one of a member of a number of multilateral organizations, where its role can play out. During the 1988 campaign, and I should say, he's the first person to be elected president to hold that view, but he's not the first prominent American politician. In the 1988 election, George H.W. Bush, referring to his opponent, Governor Michael Dukakis of Massachusetts, said, Bush said the following, my opponent sees the United States as another pleasant country out there on the UN roll call somewhere between Albania and Zimbabwe. And you could say exactly the same thing about Obama. And I think that when you look at these attitudes, you can see how they're beginning to play out in American foreign policy. I think to the detriment of the United States and to the detriment of allies that that have depended on the United States to provide stability in international affairs, at least since the end of World War II. For example, in the area of nuclear armaments, we are in the middle of a two-week-long period that I think by the end will fairly be described as the most substantial reduction, largely in unilateral terms, in America's nuclear umbrella since the beginning of the Cold War. The treaty that he will sign with President Medvedev of Russia tomorrow in Prague will result not only in a substantial reduction from an already small base of operationally deployed nuclear warheads, but will also restrict U.S. delivery systems in ways not comparably found on the Russian side. Now, the effect of this will, I think, be to impair the American nuclear umbrella and to impair our conventional capabilities to deliver warheads using the same launch platforms that we would use for nuclear weapons. Now, it's true that the same restrictions will apply to the Russians, but bear this in mind, the Russians don't have any allies in the world. They obviously have a legitimate interest in their own self-defense, but the only other country you could even vaguely say they have an interest in defending is Belarus, I mean, if you want to. We have our NATO allies, we have our allies in East Asia and the Pacific, we have a broad range of threats that that we need to be prepared to deter and counter if need be, that the Russians simply don't face, which is one reason why the Treaty of Moscow that was negotiated during the Bush administration had different levels. The range was 1,700 to 2,200 deployed nuclear warheads, with the U.S. at the top end of the range and the Russians at the bottom. Moreover, yesterday in Washington, the President released the Nuclear Posture Review, which is a document. This is the third Nuclear Posture Review under the current legislation, reviewing what our nuclear policy will be during the remainder of the administration. And the President, in this Nuclear Posture Review, said that there would be no further expenditures for the reliable replacement warhead, that is to say, the next generation of warhead to replace the aging warheads currently in our stockpile. Moreover, the Nuclear Posture Review said that expenditures on the safety and reliability of the existing stockpile would be substantially reduced from what many members of Congress thought would be the budgeted level over the next 5 years. Now, the consequence of this, combined with the low limits in the what they call the New START Treaty, is very significant. Warheads, nuclear warheads, age, just like we do. Not just like we do, but they age. The plutonium or uranium in the warheads is emitting radioactivity all the time. The radioactivity affects the high explosives packed around the warheads. And causes the explosives to degrade. That can affect both the safety and reliability of the warheads and therefore the safety and reliability of the deterrent capability itself. We have not tested a nuclear warhead in nearly 20 years, so we rely on computer projections and mathematical simulations of what happens in the aging process. That probably tells us pretty close to reality what in fact is going to happen. But without developing new warheads and without spending enough on diagnostic testing, and in my view, without at some point actually testing again, we don't know whether the warheads will work when they're called upon to work. And since you only get one shot per warhead, if you drop it and it doesn't go off, you don't get to try it again, this is a potential problem because it calls into question the credibility of the deterrent itself. And this is true on the safety side as well. One nuclear scientist once said to me, imagine you had a garage filled with 10,000 automobiles, every one of which you expected to start the first time you turned the switch, the key in the ignition, and none of which you expected to start before you turned that key. That is, gives some indication of the magnitude and the importance of having a credible deterrent, which I think we are in the process of unilaterally giving up. All the while, the Russians are building new generations of warhead, increasing their delivery system capabilities, and otherwise modernizing their nuclear force, as I might add, is China. Now, a lot of this in Obama's view is because it is the United States' obligation under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, as it is of the other four legitimate nuclear weapon states, to reduce their nuclear stockpiles in fulfillment of the bargain that the non-nuclear weapon states entered into not to develop nuclear weapons, so that American reductions in its nuclear capabilities will inspire would-be proliferator states to stop their own proliferation, and will encourage other states to apply more pressure to these would-be proliferators than would otherwise be the case. Now, this is an interesting exercise in theology with no empirical basis in the real world. Number one, it misstates the bargain of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. The bargain was not that the weapon states give up their weapons in exchange for the others not developing such weapons. The bargain was that the non-nuclear weapon states would get assistance for legitimate, peaceful, civil nuclear power, which they are, in fact, getting through the IAEA and other sources. So the whole argument that somehow there's an obligation other than a vague promise in the NPT for the five nuclear weapon states to reduce their arsenals is just not found in the negotiating record. I might say this is a position that applies not just to the United States, but all five legitimate nuclear weapon states, Russia, Britain, France, and China as well. And all of them would basically say the same thing. Moreover, the idea that unilateral reductions of American capabilities, whether or not tied in treaties with Russia, will have an impact on would-be proliferators like Iran and North Korea is just fanciful. If anything, in Tehran and Pyongyang, they're reading the Nuclear Posture Review, they're reading the text of the treaty that will be signed in Prague, they're watching American force levels come down, and they're saying, fantastic, let's ramp up our own production so we can have an even greater nuclear capability to deploy against potential targets in our regions. But this is the kind of naive, otherworldly faith that Obama has in multilateral undertakings like the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And it, you will see this, I think, played out in a variety of other contexts as well, which over a sustained period of time, I think, will leave the United States weaker, leave its alliance partners more at sea, and leave the world a less secure, less stable place than if these policies had not been adopted. So for those who think that the U.S. has exercised excessive hegemonic force in the world over the past four decades, who long for the state of anarchy that existed before this hegemonic influence was established, and who can't wait for U.S. power in the world to be reduced, congratulations, you're about to see it happen. Thank you very much. So as I say, I'd be happy to answer questions, and I'll come over here and sit down.
Okay. Let's throw it open to any anarchists on the floor. Please, if you can remember, let us know who you are when you ask the question. Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Bolton, my name is Paul Surtees. My question concerns Iran, which you touched on earlier. Would you share with us, please, what do you think the Obama administration will do if, as seems likely, Iran gets closer and closer to having nuclear arms? And
nothing.
Secondly, what do you think they should do?
The Obama administration policy on Iran and Iran's nuclear program has manifestly failed, as has the actually quite similar Bush administration policy. These policies were modeled on the approach taken by what we call the EU3, Britain, France, and Germany, which for close to 8 years, beginning in late 2002, tried an approach diplomatically to persuade Iran to give up its, at that point, nearly 15-year-long pursuit of nuclear weapons. And the EU3 policy was incentives and disincentives, carrots and sticks. If Iran would give up its uranium enrichment program, Iran could have a different relationship with the Western world. Everybody understood from the outset. Everybody understood from the outset that the EU3 spoke for the United States as well as for themselves, and that were Iran to forswear the pursuit of nuclear weapons, that it would have a different relationship with us as well as with the European Union. Iran consistently over this period refused to do anything require it to give up any aspect of its nuclear program. The Europeans would go to Iran every 3 or 4 months with a list of carrots that was this long and a list of sticks that was this long. They'd present them to the Iranians, and the Iranians would say, well, this is very interesting. This is a sound basis for discussion. Now, on this list of carrots, this is an excellent beginning, but it's too short. And on this list of sticks, we reject them. The Europeans would sit there, and it would sort of dimly penetrate that they were not getting anywhere. They'd go back to their capitals. 3 months later, they'd go again and say, all right, we've got a list of carrots and sticks. The list of carrots would be like this. The list of sticks would be even shorter. And we just, it's like Groundhog Day, just keep doing it. And the Europeans kept saying, you know, we're just looking for the right combination of carrots and sticks here to get the Iranians to give up their nuclear weapons program. And there never was the right combination because, here's the magic, the Iranians never planned to give up their nuclear weapons program. So after it became clear that they'd actually have to drag a stick out, we passed 3 sanctions resolutions in the Security Council against Iran. In December of 2006, in March of 2007, and March of 2008. Those 3 sanctions resolutions had zero impact on Iran's nuclear weapons program. So comes the 20th of January 2009, where in the Obama canon, history begins anew, and he says, I've got an idea about how to deal with the Iranians. We'll have a package of incentives and disincentives, carrots and sticks. 14 months later, the Iranians won't even talk to him. This is amazing to me. If I were the Iranians, looking at the way Obama negotiates, I'd get him at the table as soon as I could. But they won't even talk to him. So now we see that the administration is engaged in a campaign for a 4th Security Council sanctions resolution against Iran's program. They will get a 4th resolution. It will be marginally tougher than the first 3. But like the first 3, it will have zero impact on Iran's nuclear weapons program. The issue is not, can you get a 4th sanction that marginally torques up the cost of Iran's noncompliance, but can you find sanctions that will stop Iran from continuing to pursue nuclear weapons? And the answer to that is no, it is too late. Sanctions are, we are beyond the point where sanctions can have an impact. So, as of today, the most likely outcome is that Iran gets nuclear weapons. Now, I think that's really the Obama administration's backup plan. They won't like Iran with nuclear weapons, but they, like many people, especially in Europe, believe that Iran can be contained and deterred. I think that is illusional. I don't think that the analogy to deterrence in the Cold War works for a variety of reasons. I'll try and summarize it very quickly. In the Cold War, for a variety of reasons, the Soviet Union and the United States shared a sufficient calculus that it was not in anybody's advantage to launch a nuclear salvo. I don't think the psychology that obtained in the Cold War obtains with Tehran. Say whatever you want about communism, they were atheists, they only thought they went around once in life, they weren't about to throw that away too quickly. That's not the view of the leadership in Tehran, which prizes life in the hereafter more than it does life on Earth. I get nervous dealing with people like that, and I think with good reason. The American view, I think, is much closer to the Kenny Chesney country and western song, which goes, everybody want to go to heaven, nobody want to go now. So that balance doesn't obtain with the Iranians. But even if I were wrong about that, it doesn't stop with Iran. If they get nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia will, Egypt will, Turkey will, perhaps others. So in 5 to 10 years, you'll have a multipolar nuclear Middle East. It's inherently unstable. Somebody's going to use them first, and then we're going to be in the soup. The only thing that stands between us and a nuclear Iran today is the potential of an Israeli military strike. Will they do it? I don't know, but that's all there is. If I were advising the president, I'd say we should help Israel carry out that strike. In fact, I would go further and say we should strike first because we can do it right.
In the middle, please.
Thank you. My name is Bruce Aiken. I just wanted to comment a little bit on the term American exceptionalism, because I think that the problem with the Bush administration is they took American exceptionalism to the height of arrogance. And another problem that I see is in regard with the what I would call the
hypocrisy. Just out of curiosity, where was it that our height of arrogance was displayed?
Sorry?
Where was it that the height of our arrogance was displayed?
Well, I think Iraq would be a good opinion, and a good place, and then probably Afghanistan as well.
You'd rather have Saddam Hussein still in power in Iraq?
Well,
yes or no?
Saddam
Sorry,
Hussein?
I don't. Go ahead. Sorry.
That's okay. I mean, who provided Saddam Hussein with his chemical weapons? I think it was America.
Not us. No, not true. Sorry.
I think America wanted him to use it on the Iranians instead of the Kurds, probably. But anyway, to get on.
I think it was Henry Kissinger who said, "In a war between Iran and Iraq, we're in favor."
Well, to get on to another point, on UN sanctions and resolutions, I would submit it that it's actually the United States that has made the UN irrelevant, because there are about 65 resolutions against Israel that are always vetoed by America. And I thank God for Obama.
I vetoed too myself.
I think Obama has the courage to maybe abstain and bring into check the real terrorists in the Middle East, this apartheid racist regime that is persecuting the people of Palestine on a daily basis and causing most of the big problems in the world. So this is the problem with American foreign policy.
Aren't you going to accuse me of being part of the Zionist conspiracy while we're on the subject?
Zionists.
I'm a Lutheran myself.
If you criticize Israel, you're right away. You said anti-Semitic. But America spends $7 to $15 million a day supporting this country that is persecuting the people. I submit this is the real terrorist in the world, and this is why America has all this foreign policy problems. So I thank God for Obama, and let's give him a good chance, because the world is tired of American military views to solve every problem. The world wants peace, and thank God that he's looking at some of the big problems that exist in America. It's about time America solved some of its own big problems and stay out of everybody else's hair.
We certainly welcome members of the audience to challenge our speakers and engage in debate, so thank you for that. You responded to quite a bit of that as the question.
Just let me ask one question.
Along,
given that Israel is a terrorist state, how many terrorist democracies do you know? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I think Hamas was the elected democracy in Palestine, but that wasn't good enough. And the problem is with Israel is, why is always Israel left out of the nuclear equation? It's armed to the hilt with nukes supplied by America. So why not bring Israel into the fold, too?
It's been America's consistent position for 40 years, at least, that we favor the elimination of all nuclear weapons in the Middle East.
Israel's always left out. You mentioned Iran.
Let me ask you something. Do you think Iran with nuclear weapons is equivalent in danger to Britain with nuclear weapons? In other words, do you think every nuclear weapons state is exactly equal? Well, I'm very close to you. I wish only one country had nuclear weapons.
Good luck. Can I just ask a question following up on all this? I mean, you're very critical of the extreme to which you think Barack Obama has taken his multilateral approach in all different areas. But wouldn't you allow that one of the reasons that there has been that reaction is that Bush did go too far in taking his version of American exceptionalism, whether it's Kyoto or Iraq or you name it?
Well, let's go down the list. I mean, I think Kyoto was a very bad treaty. In fact, I think that the argument that there's some obligation to accept and ratify treaties, even if they are substantively bad policy, is unsustainable. So, I mean, I'd be happy to go case by case on whether the Bush administration was exceptionally unilateral or not. I think there's a very strong case that what we did was to pursue instrumentally the policy that we felt was most advantageous to the United States and its allies. That's what every other government in the world does. And so I don't know what the distinction, therefore, is between U.S. policy in that regard and anybody else's policy. If you don't think in the U.N., for example, China doesn't pursue its national interests, then there's a bridge that goes to Brooklyn we should talk about. Everybody pursues their national interest, and the United States in that regard under the Bush administration was no different than anybody else.
Francis.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Two quick questions, I hope.
The first is,
do you think that Governor Bradford could have been described as the first post-British colonial governor? And the second question I would like to put to you is, you mentioned nuclear testing. What do you think the reaction of the American people, as well as the reaction of people around the world, would be if there were to be a unilateral resumption of nuclear testing?
Well, the premise of that question is that there's no nuclear testing going on now anywhere else. And I think there's a lot of reason to believe that there is nuclear testing that violates the existing test ban treaty going on in both Russia and China. I think this is obviously an extraordinarily sensitive subject, but the fact is that when the United States stopped testing during the Bush 41 administration, it did so without an adequate basis to think that it could that the moratorium on testing would last forever. And the reason for that is that Americans in their own nuclear program had not really done a lot of diagnostics. We'd set off a test. If we didn't fully understand it, we'd set off another test. We sort of did it that way. And the ultimate proof of safety and reliability is not found alone in computer simulations, but is found in testing. So if you want a safe and reliable nuclear stockpile, then you have to have a basis of confidence that it will work when you ask it to. And it is true in as a fundamental proposition of science that science is rest on repeated experiments. So having gone for 20 years without testing a nuclear weapon, especially without testing nuclear weapons that have been around for 20 years and have had 20 years of radioactive decay going on, we can't know for certain what the safety and reliability of the stockpile is. Now, I'm not saying we have to test tomorrow, but it's just the basis of the scientific method that eventually you have to test sometime. And I think that that day will come. We can postpone it, and I don't have any difficulty with postponing it, but you can't do that without much greater expenditure than the Obama administration is willing to put into it, at least based on the nuclear posture review that they published yesterday.
My question, though, went to public reaction, not to any need for reliability as you've described it. How do you think people would respond?
Well, I think you need to. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure anybody's polled on it in a long time, but I think with careful explanation, if you ask people, do you want a safe and reliable nuclear stockpile or don't you care, they'd say, we want a safe and reliable nuclear stockpile.
We can take at least two more questions right in the corner there and then against the wall.
My name is Paul Christensen. Sorry, just a quick follow-up on that, though. Using your analogy of the 1,000 cars in the garage, you go into the garage, you turn one car on and it works. That doesn't really tell you very much about how reliable the other 999 are. I mean, I'm not a professional statistician, but frankly, to have reliable scientific data on whether that stockpile works, you need more than one test. You probably need to test about 3 to 5% of the stockpile to be confident at a reasonable level that the rest of it would work.
Fine by me.
Hundreds of nuclear explosions.
No, look, it is a question of phasing out the older weapons and creating new ones. And one of the things that the Obama administration said yesterday is they're not going to create the reliable replacement warhead, which Secretary of Defense Gates said when he was a Republican that made it impossible to believe that you could have a truly credible nuclear deterrent. Now, if you want to take the position that the credibility of the nuclear deterrent doesn't matter anymore, that's a position you can take. I think fundamentally that's the direction the Obama administration is going in. I think that's the path to global insecurity.
Hey there. My name is Dan Ryan. I'm working for a tech company here in Hong Kong. The term neoconservatism is a much abused one as a school of foreign policy thinking.
It's okay. I'm not a neoconservative.
Sure. No. I know. I understand that. I understand. What do you understand by the term, and what school of foreign policy thought do you subscribe to, and how would you distinguish your thinking from the neoconservatism, if indeed that it can be nailed down?
Yeah, my foreign policy is pro-American. That's how I describe myself. Neoconservatives during the Reagan administration were described by someone whom I can't remember as liberals who were mugged by reality. I've always been a conservative, so I was never mugged by reality. Yeah. Well, I think the neoconservatives tend to be people who believe more in the advantages of pursuing a pro-democracy foreign policy. So, for example, they would have argued that democratic reform in Iraq alone was a sufficient reason to overthrow Saddam Hussein. I've never believed that. I think it's a nice bit of value added, but I think the real reason to overthrow Saddam Hussein was to finish the first Persian Gulf War and end the threat to peace and security in the Middle East that he posed. I think the neoconservatives also tend to believe in the democratic peace theory, which is simply, oversimply stated, that democracies don't go to war with each other. I think given that democracies, as we understand it, we've only seen in the past couple of hundred years, and that human history is 100,000 years long, to take our statistician friend over there, that doesn't give you necessarily a reliable basis to believe that democracy, that the spread of democracy inevitably results in a greater likelihood of international peace. But I think, honestly, that's what they believe, and therefore that's the basis for much of what they would call a more moral foreign policy for the United States and others.
We could take another question from the floor if there is one. Right in the back, please. And by the way, if you're in the back and not in my line of sight, you can always get the staff's attention.
Good afternoon, Peter Georgiou. The question is, it's two questions really. Do you think there are division in the ranks in the Obama administration as to this policy that is being signed in Prague? And two, do you think should there be a change in control of the Senate or the House in November, that could be undone?
Well, I think that the nuclear posture review was unquestionably months late in coming out. And it reflected enormous disagreement within the administration between people who wanted to go further and, for example, forswear the first use of nuclear weapons entirely, versus what did come out, which is confused at best. And as a veteran of government bureaucracies, I can tell you that the obscure language that's used was probably hashed out in any number of interagency meetings to reach mutual agreement, and that every agency involved has a different view of what the language actually means. I think that that this policy certainly can be reversed, but because it's fundamentally an executive branch policy, it's not something that even change of control of the House and the Senate would do much to alter. And the risk is that 2.5 more years of Obama or 6.5 more years of Obama takes you far enough down the road that I could easily see a return of the famous window of vulnerability, where our delivery systems have aged, our weapons have aged, and the credibility of the deterrent would take years to rebuild, during which point we and others would be exposed to the potential of nuclear blackmail. And so I think this is a very real risk. It's not one that has received much debate in the United States, but I think it will over the need now to try and ratify the treaty that will be signed tomorrow in Prague. And I think it will run into real resistance. And I think for those who are waiting for the Senate to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, you can continue to wait on that for a long time, because that's not going to happen. The Constitution wisely requiring 2/3 of senators to give their advice and consent to treaties submitted. I don't think they can find 2/3 for the Prague Treaty. They can't find 2/3 for the CTBT, and after November, they won't come anywhere close to it.
Just as a final follow-up to that, obviously, given your background, your interests, your audience here today, you focus your critique on Obama's foreign policy. From my impression of the debate back in the U.S., even from what I see on Fox News, which is always entertaining.
Thank you for watching.
It doesn't really seem to, all these issues you raise, whether it's North Korea or Iran, doesn't seem to really be resonating in the American domestic debate. Am I wrong about that? Are these issues which will matter come November, or does it not enter into the domestic equation?
Well, I think it does enter into the domestic equation more as it relates to international terrorism than these more abstract nuclear questions. It'll be empirically verifiable in November. But the analyst who looked at Scott Brown's win in the Massachusetts Senate seat, a truly tectonic shift in American politics. For those of you who don't follow it, if a Republican can win Teddy Kennedy's Massachusetts Senate seat, there is not anything in the country that we can't potentially win. Their polls showed that while opposition to Obama's health care proposal was the predominant view, that Scott Brown's views on national defense and terrorism were a very major factor in his win. Whether that's can be replicated in other elections or not, I don't know. But I do think that whatever debate there is over the New START treaty with Russia will have an effect on that this November.
Well, we are out of time. Please join me in thanking Ambassador Bolton for his articulate and always provocative remarks. We are always interested to hear them when you're coming through Hong Kong. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I should also note, because we don't do it enough, thank you all for your questions and comments, because these events wouldn't be the same without them. As is customary, we have a token for our visitor, and today we have a Sarah Palin 2012 sweatshirt for you. If it doesn't work out, we'll get you the 2016 one.
Thanks very much. Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Can you get a picture of you against the backdrop here?